I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. There are thousands of plots of land in Philadelphia owned by U.S. Bank in a failed bond sale deal with the city that goes back to 1997. Some have been turned into community gardens, side yards, and green spaces rescued by residents who wanted to put the land to use rather than have them become an eyesore. Now those plots are at risk because the bank wants to sell them off by October 2023 at Sheriff's sale. Philadelphia Councilmember-at-Large Kendra Brooks has a plan she calls Restore Community Land. Have the city buy the plots for $10 million and let the residents buy them through the land bank. She says it's an effort to right the wrongs of the city's past treatment of black and brown communities and forge a path toward land sovereignty. She joins us on Radio Times. Kendra Brooks, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me as well.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Sonia Galiber. She's an organizer with Soil Generation, a grower and herbalist here in Philadelphia. Sonia Galiber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much. I'm a big fan. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. Kendra Brooks, let me begin with you. In my introduction, I said thousands of plots of land. How many plots are we actually talking about here?
It's approximately around 2,000. Plots of land throughout the city.
And are they in, as you said, throughout the city, are do you find them in specific neighborhoods, or are they scattered throughout the entire city?
There are higher numbers in certain areas throughout the city, North Philadelphia, West Philadelphia, and parts of Germantown. We found a large number of plots.
Now, some of them have been, in a sense, sort of claimed by the neighbors and turned into gardens and green spaces. Are some of these other plots, though, just trash-strewn and vacant and abandoned?
Well, keep in mind, some of these lots are also side lots.
Right.
They were smaller plots that are in between two properties that community members have taken over because of what you said, to prevent blight, to prevent dumping. They have stewarded over this land for multiple years. And they vary from side lots as well as large parcels. They can be multiple plots.
So how would your plan work? Assuming you can get the $10 million, how would it work?
Our goal is to buy back the properties from U.S. Bank and allow communities to take over ownership of those land, of the individual lands. And it will look very different whether it's a community garden, a side lot, or a parcel of land. It could vary what the buyback or ownership of the land looks like based on the status of the individual properties. But I think, you know, I always say the devil's in the details.
Of like, course.
we only have a few months to buy back these lands. The goal of U.S. Bank is to get rid of them by October.
By October, I said 2023. I'm wrong. It's 2022, correct?
Right. It's 2022.
Okay.
October.
My mistake on that. Does the city have $10 million that's willing to invest in this project?
Well, that's kind of what I'm working on. We're working on multiple ways the city could use the $10 million. We talked. We're in conversation with Council President's office. Around where the money would come from, like exactly. So we have some MPI funding that was available that we could potentially use for this. We do have the new property assessment that people are talking about that could raise $92 million. $10 million would be a drop in the bucket, and it would be a give back as well to communities. Even though we're still trying to figure out the logistics of the property assessments, because they too are also
complicated
and inequitable for certain communities.
Sure.
We have communities that are being double assessed now, and some communities, you know, that are, you know, not really paying their fair share around taxation. So that's a little complicated.
Right.
And then we have some unspent ARP or ARPA funds that we could possibly use for this. So I think, once again, we're working out where the $10 million would come from, but the sense of urgency is there because if we don't do this now, this is a lost opportunity forever. And
well,
when we see the specific areas that I'm talking about are communities that are already enamored with displacement due to gentrification.
Hold, if you don't mind, just holding on. Let me get Sonia Galabert in on the conversation. What would this mean from your perspective as someone who's part of Soil Generation and part of this land and food justice initiative here in Philadelphia?
I think this is a pretty monumental moment. I think we've really struggled with trying to get more institutional support and understanding the value of these spaces and having help protecting these spaces. Our biggest challenge, I think, has been reclaiming the narrative that urban agriculture and gardening is not just a hobby, especially for historically underinvested communities. And so being able to preserve these spaces and begin a process of community land ownership would mean securing, you know, food hubs and microeconomies in communities that have self-determined solutions to social issues that have gone, you know, overlooked for generations at this point.
Help us understand about Philadelphia's, and I'm putting this to you, Sona, Philadelphia's really robust agricultural scene here in the city.
Yeah, I think it's important for folks to understand that the history of urban agriculture spans really throughout Philly's history. Over different decades, different populations have moved into the city and brought their agricultural foodways with them, whether it's Black folks from the South fleeing Jim Crow during the Great Migration, or folks from Southeast Asia who may be, you know, displaced due to war and bringing their seeds and foodways with them too. And so this is really a lot more than a hobby. It's a way of preserving culture, of creating space for community, and also feeding ourselves.
And is it also about justice?
Absolutely. I think growing food is inherently political in a time and place where access to food is not something that's guaranteed. A lot of language around food inaccessibility is food desert. And a lot of movements are shifting away from that and calling it food apartheid because deserts are naturally occurring. Right. And inaccessibility to food is a man-made construct as a result of decades of discrimination through policy.
Kendra Brooks, let me go back to you. You mentioned developers. Do you feel like you're in a race against developers who are obviously looking at land as well?
Yes, I do. I think, so when we think about this land, when we're talking about for the community, we're also talking about opportunities for low income, affordable housing as well, some of the larger parcels. So this is part of the broader conversation, to Sonia's point around food sovereignty and food justice, but how can we restore communities that have been disinvested in for generations, and these parcels of land were allowed to sit and become dilapidated and became places and crime hubs. And we're talking about a pure restoration. And restoration has, you know, around, you know, growing and nature, but also around shelter for folks, which is essential currently in our city.
And there's been some really robust research, Kendra Brooks, that looks at what happens when there is green space or a garden or a green side yard in a neighborhood, that the quality of life in that neighborhood is measurably improved. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Like, you know, so the city has just made an investment of greening areas and painting and removing debris and rubbers because we realize that areas that have, to your point, green space, and, you know, they see less crime. You know, so this is a way for us to restore these communities that we still continue to disinvest in. It is also a way to empower communities to be a part of that change. You know, sometimes, you know, I'm a restorative practitioner. We always talking about how we can do things with people and allowing communities to be a part of the change that they want to see. Urban gardening is a perfect way of doing it and making sure that people have ownership of the land that's in their communities.
Sonia, you're an herbalist, you're a grower. What are you growing this season?
I'm actually reporting from Parkway Northwest High School, where I facilitate an eco arts program with the high schoolers here.
Cool.
So over here, we've got blueberries, some African basil, we have strawberry bushes, and all kinds of herbs and lettuces and flowers over here.
And obviously getting the students involved in growing their own food, correct?
Absolutely. I think one of my greatest joys of doing this work is being a facilitator for young people to build a relationship with nature and see all of the different ways that the land is always serving us, whether we're aware of it or not. And to also become critical thinkers around the food that we consume and the implications of the food that we eat on a larger scale, whether it's within the city or on a global scale.
Did you grow up in a family of farmers or growers?
I did. I come from a family of farmers on my mother's side, and I gotta say I didn't grow up as a child imagining myself farming, but I did have a passion for social justice, and after trying a lot of different kinds of justice-oriented work, I found that food, water, air, land is what I call comprehensive justice, right? Like, everybody needs it, everybody wants it, and it felt like a way to tap into systemic change because of the way these spaces are able to touch food justice, economic justice, health justice, and even environmental justice.
Kendra Brooks, are you a grower? Do you have a garden?
Yes, I do. I dabble a little bit in it. And I, too, come from, my stepfather was from the South, grew up gardening. Well, not even that back then, it was sharecropping. But he, when we moved to Philadelphia, he kept a small garden in a yard that I never really participated in. I just knew that was where he would spend most of his time. And then they moved to Florida so he could have, when he retired, to have a larger parcel of land to garden on. And actually, I just recently came back to it since I've been in council. It has been my peace. And I have string beans this year. I have some squash. I have a small herb garden, and I usually do tomatoes and peppers. And it's something I did with my grandchildren during COVID. You know, I was my daughter and my son-in-law are both essential workers. So the children were with me. So I had two 3-year-old twins.
Wow.
And a 5-year-old and running counseling sessions all day.
You were very busy.
So this was our thing, and I just kept up with it. And now they just come peek on it from time to time. It has become my piece during council.
Yeah, yeah. We're almost out of time. So is the clock ticking then on this $10 million, Kendra Brooks?
Yes, it is. I believe that we will win. I believe that, you know, with the work of Soil Generation and the growers throughout the city, you know, and the support of my council colleagues that have been working on this way before I got here, I think we will be able to restore this to communities. And I look forward to being able to see what this victory is at the end.
Me as well. Thank you so much, Kendra Brooks, for joining us today in Radio Times. And she joined us to talk about Restore Community Land. She's Philadelphia Council Member at Large. Sonia Galabert, organizer with Soil Generation, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well. And up next, getting rid of the lawn. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. According to the EPA, we use 3 trillion gallons of water on our lawns every year to keep them green, almost 60 million pounds of pesticides to keep the weeds away, and 3 billion gallons of gas mowing them. Our guest, Douglas Tallamy, says it creates a kind of wasteland that could be put to better and more productive use. He's a wildlife ecologist and entomologist, and he's got a big, bold idea. Help create what he calls a homegrown national park by reducing or eliminating your lawn, removing invasive species, and planting native plants, shrubs, even oak trees to attract diverse wildlife. That patchwork of yards could help restore lost habitats, fight climate change, and create an environment that supports life. He's a professor at the University of Delaware, author of several books, including The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees, and Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Backyard. Douglas Tallamy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I remember talking to you a couple of years ago about this idea, this homegrown national park, the goal to get to something like 20 million acres of yards that become part of this patchwork of park. How's it going? How many acres do we have yet? Do we know?
We have an idea. We have over 15,000 people who have registered their properties. We need a lot more than that. We chose 20 million acres as a goal because we have, as of 2005, 40 million acres of lawn. So we said, well, if we cut the area of lawn in half, that gives us 20 million acres. But when you look at the greater amount of land that's in residential landscapes, it's 135 million acres, which is six times larger than the New England. So our 20 million acre goal is rather modest. And we're encouraging people that, yes, we want to reduce the area of lawn, but if you have a woodlot on your property, if you have a flower pot on your porch, anything that can contribute to ecological function in your yard, that deserves to go onto Homegrown National Park. Get yourself registered. We're trying to change the culture by getting the message that everybody has a responsibility to good earth stewardship. Everybody, no matter where you live, no matter how much property you own. We want that message to go viral, and we're using this Homegrown National Park get on the map idea as a social media vehicle to make that happen.
You know, I have to say, when I go to my local garden centers, I do see many more native plants that people can purchase. Are you seeing an interest in and even support for the idea of using native plants in one's yard?
Very much so. The demand for native plants now far exceeds the supply, which is a business opportunity.
Right.
You know, people are responding to the terrible headlines that we're seeing regularly. We've got global insect decline. We've lost 3 billion breeding birds in the last 50 years. The UN says we're going to lose a million species in the next 20 years. None of these are long-term options if we humans are going to remain on this planet, and people are upset about it. My message is you can do something about it and start right where you live.
Well, let's start where a lot of people live. We're obviously talking about people with some plot of land, whether it's, I guess, urban or suburban or even rural. So what should we do about our lawns that I described, you know, with all the water and pesticides that go into maintenance for so many lawns? What should we do about it?
Right. Well, you know, the lawn is a status symbol, which is why we put so much effort into having them be perfect. They're a display of our good citizenship. So we're starting to recognize that actually when you do those things, you're not such a good citizen anymore. You're certainly not a good ecological citizen. So I suggest cutting the area of lawn in half or reducing the amount of lawn you have. So right away, you've reduced those terrible statistics. But lawn is still a very good cue for care. It shows that you are a participating member in your neighborhood. You're not a renegade. You're going to fit in. But you're going to have less lawn. The important thing is what you put in place of that lawn. And this is where I would promote plants like oaks. We call them keystone species because they're supporting more life than any other type of plant. That's just an example. But if you were going to do one thing, I would say plant an oak tree in your yard.
Well, in fact, you have done that, and you noticed the amount of what caterpillars that the oak tree becomes home to. Help us understand what's going on there.
Yeah, we measure caterpillars because caterpillars are transferring more energy from plants to other animals than any other type of plant eater.
Really?
So if you know the number of caterpillars in your food web, you know how vibrant that food web is. Well, oaks nationwide support more than 950 species of caterpillars. In the mid-Atlantic states where we are here, 557 species. Compared to, say, a tulip tree, which is a good native plant, but they only support 21.
Hmm.
Or a crepe myrtle, which is not a native plant, supports zero. So there's a huge differences among the plants we put in our yards in terms of their ability to make caterpillars. Why do we care about caterpillars? Well, let's say you want a breeding bird in your yard. Let's say you want a chickadee. It takes 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to make one clutch of chickadees, just to get them to the point where they leave the nest. So you need a lot of caterpillars to have a vibrant food web in your yard.
So look, I mean, so people should look in their yard and look for caterpillars, and the more caterpillars, the healthier your yard.
Yes, the more native caterpillars. Native. Now we're not talking about non-natives. We're not talking about what is now the spongy moth, not the gypsy moth anymore. We're not talking about emerald ash borer or any of these insects we brought in. They're invasive species without natural enemies. Nothing's controlling them. But the native caterpillars that are an essential component of our food web is what you're looking for. But, you know, this is not a good time of year to look for them because the birds are out there eating everyone they find.
That's true.
So people say, I can't find any of those caterpillars. I said, no, they're in the tummy of your little birds. But I bet you see the birds, so...
Well, I have a true confession. I mean, now my yard is not a perfect, it's mostly weeds, but nonetheless, I do mow it. And I like it. I like looking at it. Now, bit by bit, I've sort of, you know, built out beds and things and put in native plants. But nonetheless, maybe I'm one of those not good citizens that you were talking about, Dr. Talaby. I just have to confess. That's all.
No, you know, we love neatness, absolutely. And that's why I say it's a cue for care. The lawn you keep should be mowed. It should be manicured. That doesn't mean you have to apply herbicides and fertilizer. If you mow it, it'll stay green and it'll be nice. But it's the areas that you're not mowing that we're really going to focus on. Lawn, no matter how big it is never going to support a lot of anything because you are mowing it once a week. So no, you're not a bad person, Marty. You're a typical human who likes, you know, we just like to control things around us.
And
that's just part of our genetic heritage.
You suggest, though, mowing at 3 inches, which is, I think for a lot of people, that feels like tall grass in the yard.
Yeah. It means you'll have to mow less frequently, believe it or not. It means when it stops raining and we have a drought that your grass will stay greener longer. So which means you don't have to water. That also means that if you're not applying fertilizer with herbicide in it, you can have some clover in your yard, and that will allow the clover to bloom, which then provides pollen for generalist bees like honeybees and some of our bumblebees. So your lawn is a little bit productive then if you leave it a little high. If you mow it right down to half an inch, it's just hopeless.
Okay. You mentioned the word drought, and, you know, we know about this really serious drought in the West, in California, for instance, where people are and other states out there are literally pulling up their lawns because they are unsustainable. Is that our future?
Not necessarily. It depends on where you live. It's certainly the future of the Southwest. They never had enough water for cool season European grasses. That's what you're talking about. So It always required extra irrigation. But in the East, you know, we get a lot of rain. We get over 40 inches of rain and more these days, it seems. So we do have enough water for yards. If you have to water, then you're not using the right plant. Now, we will go periodically through droughts. But, you know, the last serious drought we had here in the East was 2005, so it's been a while. So it doesn't mean we can't have lawns. I just want to have less area dedicated to lawns.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Douglas Talamy. He's a professor of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. He's written a couple of books, one called The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. Also, Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation that Starts in Your Own Backyard. And this is this idea, this homegrown national park that he's been talking about and writing about for some time now. And again, any questions or comments, if you want to confess your love of your yard, you can do that as well. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. One of the other things you say is to get rid of invasive species, and maybe we need a definition because it seems like that covers a lot of plants.
Actually, not as many as you think. An invasive species has to be a non-native. So a lot of people use the term invasive and aggressive as synonyms, but they're not. We have aggressive native plants, but they're They're species that have always been here, and they've been duking it out with each other, so they know how to do it together. It's when we bring in a plant from someplace else that has no natural enemies, particularly deer. We have an overabundance of deer, and they don't like our invasive non-native plants.
Oh, interesting.
And that has tipped the competitive balance against our native plants. So we have something like calorie pear or burning bush or barberry that escape our yards and move into the natural areas, and the deer won't touch them. But every oak tree or other native plant that pops up in the natural areas, the deer eat, which means now we have, you walk into the woods and you've got nothing but privet or bush honeysuckle or barberry, and you've replaced the entire understory with non-native plants. And they look like super plants, but they're hardy plants.
Yeah.
But it's the competitive disadvantage that deer impose on them that has really caused their invasiveness.
So what do we do? Just try to stay ahead of them? Obviously, don't put them in the first place, but nonetheless, since they're here and they're so aggressive, how do we get rid of them?
All these problems are intertwined. It is going to be very difficult to control our invasive plants in wild areas if we don't control deer at the same time.
Wow.
So that's another whole subject,
but
that's a necessity for the health of our forests. We can stop selling them in our nurseries. And as of July 1st in Delaware, you're not going to be allowed to sell invasive plants anymore. That's a bill that passed with unanimous support from both sides of the aisle, by the way. Mm-hmm. So more and more states are doing that. But as you say, the horse is out of the barn. So we can close the door now, but that's not going to make a big difference.
So
it's just a huge problem we have created, and there's no simple answer. But you can get rid of them on your property. 85% of the country east of the Mississippi is privately owned. So if everybody got rid of the invasives on their property, makes it a manageable goal, we'd be 85% done.
So what should people look for?
You look for the bad guys in your neighborhood. Autumn olive, porcelain berry. I always go for the woody plants first. And we have things like Japanese stilt grass, which is there's no easy way to get rid of that. So I don't start with that. Start with the things like bush honeysuckle and privet and porcelain berries. It's the kudzu of the north. There's really less than 10 species that you need to identify. And is this on my property? Yes, it is. I cut it out, and I just keep cutting it out till it's gone.
What do you have a position on ornamental plants? I'm thinking, for instance, all the azaleas and rhododendrons that we see that are in bloom or have bloomed in the last week or so here in the Delaware Valley. Mm-hmm. Should we keep them? Are they good for us? Good for the environment?
Ornamental plants are good for us. We like them. We have native azaleas. We have native rhododendrons. I've got both in my yard right now, and they're in bloom right now. I have a problem with rhododendrons because the deer love them. So they clobber them. But they're not, they're pretty. They're not very highly productive plants. So one of the things we've done in our lab is to rank plants in terms of their productivity, the amount of energy they contribute to local food webs. That's why oaks are number one, because they're contributing more energy than anything. Rhododendrons are way down there. So I certainly don't target them. They're not invasive, so they're part of what will round out your yard. But you want those, what I'm calling keystone plants, the ones. Just 14% of our native plants are making 90% of the caterpillars that drive our food webs. So you get that 14% in your yard, then you've got 86% you can play with. That isn't going to make a big difference one way or the other.
Michelle asks, she says, over the years, I've removed turf and planted a variety of native, and then she says, and non-native plants. I'm experiencing over the last couple of years a major infestation of thistle. I wonder how to eliminate this so I can nurture more healthy, natural piece of land. The thistle is relentless. And indeed it is, Doug Tallamy. What do you do about thistle?
And you're probably talking about Canada thistle, another invasive plant. It's tough because it runs it's got lateral roots, stoloniferous roots that run underground. So you can pull it up, but you're only just pulling up a rammet that isn't killing the roots. I don't know of any way to get rid of thistle other than herbicide.
Really?
Unfortunately, yeah.
And coming from you, that says a lot.
So it's not every thistle that's bad out there. We've got pasture thistle here at my house. It is not stoloniferous. It comes up as a biennial, and it's a great plant. It's a wonderful pollinator plant. But if you've got Canada thistle, you probably have a field of it, and it's I think you have to spray it.
Oh dear! I'm coming from you, Doug Tallamy. I mean, that says a lot.
Well, you know, it's like chemotherapy. you have to get rid of this cancer that's out there. And if you don't, it won't go away. So,
here's a tweet from Sean. He says, what do you do about bamboo? Cut it. And you do see these stands of bamboo that are just extraordinary. I know you can buy, you know, products made of bamboo, so there is a use for it. But nonetheless, Doug, where do you stand on bamboo?
That's why bamboo is banned in Dover, Delaware, and it has been for years. It will seriously degrade your property value. I pass a property on the way home that has been dug up with a backhoe for months now, trying to get rid of this bamboo stand. Please don't plant it, because you will rue the day. And again, it is extremely difficult to get rid of. You can cut off every stalk and paint that with an herbicide. You've got to kill the roots.
Wow.
Or it will never go away.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're up on a very short break. Let me just quickly reintroduce you and just make sure that our listeners can join our conversation. I see a lot of comments coming in. Doug Tallamy is our guest. He's a professor of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. Written a couple of books, The Nature of Oaks, Nature's Best Hope. And we began by talking about this homegrown national park idea that he has. And he says there's something like 15,000 homeowners that have signed on to help create a kind of a patchwork quilt of land that can be sewed together in a kind of way to create a homegrown national park. You can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also call us 1-888-477-9499. We began by also talking about reducing or eliminating the yard, the lawn. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Doug Tallamy about our yards, about caterpillars, about shrinking our lawn, about removing invasive species, planting native plants, and what homeowners can do to help the environment and help the critters that live in the environment. Let me just add a couple of more things to our conversation, then I do want to get to some more of our callers. One of the things you say, Doug, is when you're planting, be generous. Don't plant just like one little plant, but plant a bunch of them. Tell us why that's important.
Well, the reason you're putting this plant in your yard is not just because it's a decoration, but because it's going to support something that needs to be in your yard. Let's use the monarch butterfly as an example. Everybody wants to support monarchs by planting milkweeds, and that's great. But a lot of people will plant a single ramet of milkweed, and then, of course, a monarch flies by and lays an egg on it, and then it flies off looking for more milkweed. Oh, there's one. It'll lay another egg on it. And all of a sudden, there's two or three eggs on one stalk. They hatch, and the caterpillars eat the entire stalk. And it's not enough for them to complete their development. Or I'll have somebody say, I planted milkweed, but worms got on them, so I squished them. Of course, you know, you're trying to support the monarch. So what you need is a milkweed patch, not just a milkweed plant. Your one single plant will expand into a patch over time. But in the meantime, help it out by planting two or three or four, and that will be enough to get at least one monarch caterpillar through to maturity. If you're planting for pollinators, and we all want to do that, you want to make it easy for the pollinators to gather pollen, so they'll move from one flower to the next. If you only have two or three flowers and they've got to fly half a mile to get the next one, that's not making it easy. So you want a patch of flowers so they can forage without having to go great distances. That's why we suggest massing as opposed to single individuals.
You also suggest installing a bubbler. I mean, if you have water, have it bubbling for the birds, right?
Right. That is a cue to the birds that the water is clean. Birds typically go to babbling brooks or little waterfalls or places that the water is obviously moving. They can hear it because that signals that it's clean. The old bird baths that are just sitting there are always, it's filled with stagnant water, and you'll notice the birds don't use them. So if you have just a little, you know, a little water feature, but you put a small pump in it that keeps it circulating, the birds will use it a lot more.
And one more thing before we get back to our callers about, you know, lights outside, the impact on wildlife.
Right. We are in the midst of global insect decline. As E.O. Wilson told us, insects are the little things that run the world, and we've already lost at least half of them on planet Earth. Light pollution is one of the major causes of insect decline, particularly the nocturnal insects like moths that, of course, create those caterpillars that run the food web. So one of the easiest things you can do to help your local insect populations is turn your lights out at night. And I know people don't want to do that because the bad man's going to come, but put a motion sensor on it so it only turns on when the bad man does come, or take the white bulb out of your light, and that includes your front porch or your garage light, and put in a yellow bulb. Huh. Because yellow wavelengths are far less attractive to insects than are white wavelengths. A yellow LED is the best. If we all switched out our white lights for yellow lights overnight, we'd save millions of insects and probably millions of dollars, too, because LEDs are a lot more energy efficient.
Indeed, they are. Let me read a couple of more comments. Email from Bobby. He says, is ivy killing my trees? And I think we've all seen, you know, ivy. It looks like ivy's strangling tree trunks. Are they killing it?
Yeah, eventually. It's a tremendous weight on the tree, and it's one of those things you get an ice storm, it'll pull it down. The big thing is, now this is a perfect example. When I started to talk about this stuff, it was at least 15 years ago, there were people on the talk circuit who would say, and, you know, English ivy is invasive in Portland, Oregon, but not in the East. Of course, you know, not yet is what they meant, and now it's invasive everywhere, so... and it's another plant that is really hard to get rid of. You just have to pull out all the roots. You can get rid of it, but it's not easy. Certainly don't go and buy it. It's a beautiful plant that contributes nothing other than a decoration. And when you see it covering, I mean, go to the Pacific Northwest. It is buried in ivy. That becomes a serious ecological problem because it's not contributing energy to local food webs.
Here's a comment from Elizabeth. She says, I find old rugs, particularly orientals, in the trash and throw them over cut down bamboo and stuff, and it kills them over time completely. I tried it with knotweed and the worst stuff, and it works. It's so funny. My mother used to do that as well, to our embarrassment as children. But nonetheless, does that work, Doug?
Yeah, that's great. I hadn't heard about that for bamboo, but it makes sense. You want to smother and make sure they get no light at all, and eventually the roots will die. And I'm glad she mentioned Japanese knotweed. It's like a little bamboo, but it, particularly along water courses, terrible, terrible problem.
Here's a question from Bill. He says, I live in Western Chester County. Why am I seeing so many tent caterpillars? I've never seen them before. Doug?
Oh, they've been there before, but they're episodic. I mean, some years there's a lot of them. Some years there's very few of them. This year, not many at my house. Although I did have two tents, and I heard a noise. I went out and I looked up at one of the tents, and here was a Baltimore Oriole male hanging upside down, poking holes in the tent, and eating all the caterpillars. So people say, well, you know, they're terrible. They're killing everything. They are bird food. They are a native. People don't like them because they make a tent that kind of reminds them of a spider web and it looks ugly and then the tent stays there. But it's not our most serious problem for sure. They can strip a black cherry tree, but it will come back in a month, believe me.
So
I wouldn't. It's one of those things I would not worry about.
Here's a comment from Stuart. We have removed invasive plants, planted lots of trees in our well-manicured neighborhood in Jenkintown. While we have some invasive left, we are working with organic fertilizers to help our remaining lawn recover, promote a healthy environment for the little animals with new trees, provided lots of shade and climbing fun for our kids. Here's a question from Don. Any advice as to how to convince local code officers that you're trying to make a bug-friendly environment in your yard by not mowing it so much and by planting some call weeds or wildflowers? And, you know, there are, as you know, Doug, some neighborhood associations that really frown on the kind of lawn that I think you're suggesting a lot of people do.
Well, yes, I do know that. That's the HOA issue. But remember, I am not promoting ugly lawns. I'm promoting smaller lawns that look nice. So if you do that, they really don't have a leg to stand on, because the lawn you have is manicured and it's great. You're just going to have less lawn. By the way, the state of Maryland just passed a law saying HOAs cannot dictate how you treat the plants on your property.
Oh,
they think they can, but that is now against the law, at least in Maryland. So we're making progress. Language is important here. If you're trying to convince officials, don't say, I want to make a lot of bugs on my property. Say, maybe say, I'm trying to increase the amount of bird food. I'm trying to help the birds on my property. I'm trying to help pollinators. But don't use inflammatory language like, I want bugs, because even though that is exactly what you want, people don't get that. What you're trying to do is create a functional ecosystem where you live. Because every place we humans have gone, we've destroyed ecosystem services. We can't do that anymore. There's too many of us. We need to have functioning ecosystems everywhere, and that includes our yards. That's the goal. So use whatever language you can to get to that goal.
Right, but not the sort of inflammatory language that you were talking about. What is your What is your definition of a weed, or do you have one?
Yeah, well, there's an official one. A weed is a plant out of place. So when European settlers came here, we planted monocultures, and any plant that grew up in that monoculture, they were all native plants, were labeled weeds. So that's why we call them milkweed or Joe Pye weed or New York ironweed. They were all given names back in the colonial period because they grew up in the middle of our corn patch. But are they out of place? Well, they're out of place in your corn patch, but, you know, are they out of place in the greater environment? No. So, you know, all of the plants along the agriculture of the Midwest, actually agriculture everywhere, they were all native plants. And we spray them all and plant grass because we call them the weeds. And that's exactly why the monarch has disappeared in so many places. Because all the pollinators, those are the native plants that supported much of ecosystem function throughout our agricultural areas. That they should all be replaced, because the lawn is contributing nothing but nothing.
Nothing but ecological
problems.
Right. Yeah. Here's an email from Liz. She says, what plants are safe for dogs or not safe for dogs? Any advice for Liz?
Boy, you know, people ask me, give me a list of plants that have toxins in them. It's almost every plant that's out there. So
I assume some are more toxic than others, but...
Yeah, you know, people say that horses shouldn't eat black cherry, but really, every plant is protecting itself against insect use with some kind of a little chemical or secondary metabolic compound. If you have a dog that loves to eat plants, I can't tell you which plant would be great for him to eat that's not going to hurt him. Maybe lettuce.
Right. Here's an email from Marianne. Where can I get Doug's list of 14 best plants to use for supporting the natural environment?
Well, you know, we have a tool on the National Wildlife Federation website called Native Plant Finder, because that list changes as you move around the country. And it wasn't 14 plants. It was 14% of our native plants. So go to National Wildlife Federation website and put in Native Plant Finder, and the best plants for your county will pop up.
Mike, who's a park ranger, has a tip. He says about killing woody invasives. He says peel the bark back to the ground. Yes, Doug? Does that make sense to you?
That's called girdling it. Yeah, that does make sense. Sure, do it.
Do it. Okay, Mike, thanks for the suggestion. Here's Jessica. Can you recommend alternatives to grass that you can walk on other than ground cover? How can I find out about invasive plants by region? I think we answered that particular question, but things that you
It's one of the reasons that lawn is a good alternative, because it's one of the very few plants that you can walk on repeatedly without killing. Right. There's buffalo grass, which is a native grass from the West that does pretty well. But if you're going to walk on it and mow it regularly, just use regular lawn turf, because that works really well. That will never be the site where you're going to support a lot of wildlife. So we know that grass works well. Just use that. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm just trying to say, you want to use grass as an area rug rather than wall-to-wall carpeting. That's what Thomas Rainier suggests we do, and I think it's great advice.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Here's an email from Beverly. We have native plants and such a horrible problem of deer eating everything in our yard, including our historic plants, that leads me to the idea of switching to non-natives so the deer won't eat them. Do you have any other ideas to keep deer at bay? This is a problem here in the Delaware Valley, but go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, I mean, that is the problem, is that the deer do eat our natives. The problem is the deer. It's not the native plants. So accepting overpopulation of deer is not the solution. Mm-hmm. And getting rid of the native plants is not the solution. That just exacerbates the problem on both ends. So I understand her saying, well, I want to put plants in my yard that the deer won't touch. If everybody did that, we would take a bad situation and make it even worse in terms of creating landscapes that have ecological integrity. We can't afford to do that.
You talk about the importance of oak trees. Here's a tweet from Christopher. He says, the oaks I see in the forest are ill, bacterial blight, and rumor has it that the ash borer will jump to other species. And, I mean, the ash borer has really created quite a problem in a lot of forests. But what about oaks? Are they vulnerable to that, Doug?
No. Ash borer will not jump to other species. It is a specialist on ash. We're actually making progress with biocontrol of ash borer. So that story is actually starting to look a little bit brighter. But yes, we've introduced a number of oak diseases, bacterial leaf scorch, oak wilt. Sudden oak death syndrome is always in the West, hovering, ready to pounce in the East here. And many of our oaks are suffering. So please don't stop planting oaks. What we need to do is find the oaks that are resistant to these diseases. And the resistance is out there. We just need to plant more of them so that the susceptible trees die and then the resistant ones replace them.
Almost out of time here, but are we at a critical juncture where if we don't do some of these things, and there are other things to do as well about the environment and about the natural world, that we're going to be in big trouble?
You know, I'll refer you back to the headlines. We're going to lose 1 million species in the next 20 years. That's not an option, Marty. That is not an option. Yes, this is a critical junction. We now have more people on the planet than the planet can sustain forever. So we have to generate as much ecological or ecosystem services, the life support that keeps us alive, from the land that we occupy as possible until we stabilize our population at a sustainable level. So, yeah, this is a very critical time. We're not just talking about aesthetics here. We're talking about ecological function. We need to increase it.
Well, we have to leave it there, Doug Tallamy. Thank you for joining us today once again on Radio Times.
Well, my pleasure as always.
And he is a professor of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. I mentioned that he's written a couple of books, one called The Nature of Oaks and the other called Nature's Best Hope. And you can also Google Homegrown National Park to find out more about that idea that he has been working on for a couple of years now. Well, to replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.